singer, just a great rockabilly singer. I wanted to play a track by one of his bands to end an Ardwarda Human Serviette radio show here today, Solitary Man. In honor of Howard Ricks, your music will live on and your inspirations are many. Here are the Scramblers with Solitary Man, dedicated to Howard Ricks, who again passed away at the age of 53 yesterday, Thursday, September the 17th. Thanks, Patty, again for letting me know. Rest in peace, Howard.
I walk alone through your town and I watch you as you walk by. I've got a cigarette in a memory. Said I can get for free. I got a room with a view. Right, I wait for another night. And another night is coming round again. I never wonder where the last one went. Yeah, I'm a solitary man. I'm a solitary man. It's just the same old grind when you're a solitary man. You're a solitary for free. I'm a solitary man. You're my solitary man. You're my solitary man.
And I want you as you are on
of the world's finest films to one of the most beautiful cities on the planet. From September 24th to October 9th, the 34th annual VIFF will present over 300 films from 70 countries to 9 Vancouver screens. Visit the Vancouver International Film Festival online at viff.org.
Everything changed. Everything changed. I knew this day.
For September's Discorder magazine, go to sea with Francesca Belcourt.
I've been alone for a while now.
Also featuring articles on TV Ugly, Other Jesus, DWAC Zine, Mesa Luna, Vivo, New Editions, and Jessica McQueen. Discorder is available around town at Vancouver venues, record stores, and more. Special thanks to this month's advertisers, Victory Square, Accordion Noir, Union Events, Neptune, Viv, Fringe, Recruit in Canada, The Rio, The Rickshaw, Vinyl Records, Project Space, Hastings Crossing Business Improvement Association, Live Van, and AMS Events.
This is how I will remember.
It's the return of the 13th annual UBC Farm Aid. Farm Aid brings together UBC community members of all ages to celebrate community, local food, and local Vancouver talent, featuring vegan, vegetarian, and low-impact burgers, farm fresh corn and organic UBC farm veggies, a beverage garden featuring a local brewery, a children's area with face painting, bubble wands, and more. Free tours of the Center for Sustainable Food Systems at UBC Farm, lots of bike parking, and more at the 13th Annual UBC Farm Aid this Friday, September 18th, 3 to 8 p.m. at the UBC Farm. It's the return of the 13th Annual UBC Farm Aid. Farm Aid brings together UBC community members of all ages to celebrate community, local food, and local Vancouver talent, featuring vegan, vegetarian, and low-impact burgers, farm fresh corn and organic UBC farm veggies, a beverage garden featuring a local brewery, a children's area with face painting, bubble wands, and more. Free tours of the Center for Sustainable Food Systems at UBC Farm, lots of bike parking, and more at the 13th Annual UBC Farm Aid this Friday, September 18th, 3 to 8 p.m. at the UBC Farm.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us. Today is Friday, September 18. I'm Shem Arce.
And I'm Linda Young. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory, here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:08 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local and international news. Our first segment is our science and tech update with Marco, bringing you the last news from the world of science and technology.
We also have a broadcast of D.P. Leo's documentary for marine mammals, We Are Their Voices, about the effect on the environment has on marine mammals' habitat and lifespan. But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, UBC Farm gets $2 million donation from Nature's Path. With the help of a $2 million donation, the UBC Farm will be expanding its programs after a real estate development threatened its existence 5 years ago. The money was provided by NaturePath Foods founders Aaron and Renata Steffens and will be used to fertilize the UBC Farm. The Steffens donated the money in hopes of protecting the farm from urban development so that it may serve future generations. Aaron Steffens said in a UBC news release, quote, "My father, an organic farmer, told me to always leave the earth better than I found it. In that spirit, our investment will help preserve this farm in Vancouver, protecting it from urban development so that it can continue to serve future generations." UBC considering possible changes to mental health policy. Various changes are being considered to UBC school policy in order to positively affect the mental health of students. The AMS and other campus partners have been working on researching possible changes to academic policy to improve mental health. This includes the creation of a full reading week, establishing clear policy for syllabi, and potential changes to policy on late withdrawal from classes. Normally, when a student drops a course after the add-drop deadline, their transcript is marked with a W, regardless of potential extenuating circumstances. A later withdrawal date, where creating an added mark on students' transcripts could explain these extenuating circumstances. These changes could affect a variety of student groups. For students applying to grad school, an added mark could explain that there was a good reason for dropping a course. A full reading week could also give students a much-needed break at a time when students' counseling is typically in high demand. According to Lena Castro, the AMS Mental Health and Wellbeing Commissioner, quote, "Some of these policies haven't changed in a long time, and when they were made, maybe they didn't have mental health in mind, and so we find that a lot of this do place barriers on students' mental health and stress level in general." The work done by the AMS and its partners on academic policy has prompted the creation of an ad hoc Senate committee to further discuss the issue. Janet Mee, the Director of Access and Diversity, said that she anticipates that, quote, "This year's student senators will play a very significant role in bringing that work to the forefront." Also under review this year is Policy 73, known as Academic Accommodation for Students with Disabilities. According to me, the policy, which was drafted in 1999, is, quote, "really out of date."
In international news, a Memorial University professor refuses to wear a microphone for a hearing disabled student due to religious reasons. 20-year-old history major William Sears of Memorial University in Newfoundland requires that his instructor wears an FM transmitter system in order to hear lectures. The instructor of history of espionage class he is taking this term, Dr. René Panjavi, has refused to wear the device, citing religious reasons. Panjavi told Sears that a similar incident had occurred 20 years earlier and that she had an agreement with the university saying she will not have to wear the FM system because of religious reasons. On its website, Memorial University defines academic accommodation as, quote, "a change to teaching or evaluating procedures which is designed to accommodate the particular needs of a student with a disability without compromising academic integrity." There is no mention made of compromises to the religious belief of the instructor. The Glenn Roy Blunt Center of Students with Disabilities lists assistive devices such as the FM, assistant listening device, as an example of an academic accommodation provided to students with disabilities. Memorial University is now acknowledging that there had been a deal in place with Dr. Panjavi since 1986, which allows her to refuse to wear the device, and that they are working to find a solution. This is the first time in Sears' academic career that an instructor has refused to wear the device. He has had to drop the course as a result. Quebec introduces strong greenhouse gas emission cuts. Environment Minister David Hartle announced Thursday he wants greenhouse gas emissions cut by nearly 38% in the province. In a news conference, the minister said, quote, "A change of habits is beneficial." He also mentioned that transportation and construction are two vital areas that require reductions in gas emissions. Public consultations are scheduled for this fall, and the final target will be announced during an international conference in Paris later this year. Hartle expects the federal governments to fight climate changes by investing massively in green technology. The 37.5% target is the most ambitious in Canada.
In international news, Croatia unprepared for a wave of refugees entering from Serbia. The small village of Tovarnik at the Croatian border has been inundated by thousands of refugees entering from Serbia on their way to Germany. After 8,000 refugees passed through in a single day, Croatian Interior Minister Ranko Ostojic announced, quote, "Croatia will not be able to receive more people due to the country's insufficient resources to handle the crisis." Just a day before, Prime Minister Milanovic had announced that Croatia was fully prepared to receive refugees. Buses transporting people to refugee centers were charged and overwhelmed by people who had been waiting for hours in the heat. Police struggled to control the crowd. The wave of refugees making their way across Europe has resulted in flashpoints of confrontation that are changing daily. On Wednesday, the Hungarian town of Horgos near the Serbian border was the site of violent police clashes when a crowd of refugees broke down the border gate, trapping them between the two countries. Hungarian police fired tear gas and water cannons into the crowd. At least 7 children have been reported to be injured. Japan to close social sciences and humanities facilities at 26 universities. Back in June, a ministerial decree to the 86 universities in Japan instructed presidents to scrap or convert these departments in favor of, quote, disciplines which better serve the needs of society. Out of 60 universities that offer classes in social sciences, including law and economics, 26 plan to close or scale back these programs, including 17 universities will stop recruiting students. Opposition has already been raised by many, with one university president claiming that the decree is anti-intellectual, while universities in Tokyo and Kyoto are refusing to comply with the request. They are drawing a link between the attitude of the current Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, and his predecessor, who wanted to eliminate these facilities from all public universities. Increasing financial pressures on Japanese universities due to low birth rate and falling numbers of students are cited by Times Higher Education as motivation for this move by the Ministry of Education.
These are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break. Stay tuned.
Celebrate community, local food, and local Vancouver talent, featuring vegan, vegetarian, and low-impact burgers, farm fresh corn and organic UBC farm veggies, a beverage garden featuring a local brewery, a children's area with face painting, bubble wands, and more, free tours of the Center for Sustainable Food Systems at UBC Farm, lots of bike parking, and more at the 13th annual UBC Farm Aid this Friday, September 18th, 3 to 8 p.m. at the UBC Farm. Pop Montreal International Music Festival will run from September 16th to 20th. The 14th edition of the festival is the biggest yet and will take over Montreal for a five-day extravaganza of music, art, and film. Highlights include Thurston Moore, Ott, Giorgio Moroder, Viet Cong, Babes in Toyland, and over 400 more artists, bands, workshops, artist talks, a fashion show, a record fair, and an artisanal market. Tickets, passes, packages, and more info at popmontreal.com.
Are you not sure where to go on campus? Traveling late at night and afraid to go alone? Call SafeWalk, a free service where a co-ed team will take you anywhere you need to go on campus. Don't walk alone. For a walk, add SafeWalk to your phone. Call 604-822-5355. That's 604-822-5355. Alternatively, use a UBC Blue phone and ask for SafeWalk. Approach any SafeWalk team or drop by our office on the main floor of the sub across from the gallery lounge.
Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Bard on the Beach is under the tents at Vanier Park and going strong to September 26th. Come see a dark and hilarious comedy of errors done steampunk style, or discover a world premiere. Shakespeare's Rebel is filled with romance, political twists, and sword fighting that's up close and thrilling. All Rebel tickets are just $20 for students, and there's a low youth price for all the plays. Go to bardonthebeach.org now for details and to buy tickets.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have our science and tech upload with Marco. Take it away, Marco.
Good afternoon, everybody. There's a number of stories today, some from astronomy, two local stories, at least one from UBC, some stories on material science, where scientists are trying to develop ultra-thin or one-atom layer material, and where they're trying to develop an invisible battery. And guess what? Super Mario turns 30. In our first story, University of Saskatchewan wins what could be considered the Mars Rover World Cup. In a competition with international entrants from many other countries and many universities, The University of Saskatchewan space design team won the Mars Rover competition. This rover will be used to explore the surface of Mars, and it will make this a little easier. The University of Saskatchewan Space Design Team, USST, has won the European Rover Challenge. The challenge asked teams of students from around the world to design a robot that can handle the rough terrain of the Red Planet. Said Vice President of Engineering, Professor Austin Shirley, and quote, "It was amazing. We didn't expect to win because there were a lot of really good teams there." The six-wheel rover that was designed by the University of Saskatchewan team resembles the current rover now roaming the surface of Mars. However, the University of Saskatchewan's team, USST, made some major improvements. The new rover has a mechanical arm with a robotic arm that can perform human tasks. The rover also has large wheels, which allows it to move over big rocks. It also has a special suspension system that allows the rover's camera to stay relatively still. So when you climb rocks from one side, said Professor Austin Shirley, it keeps the whole rover chassis level. So the camera operating isn't staring at the sky the whole time when you're climbing a big rock. Professor Shirley is certain that future Mars rovers will be based on this design from the University of Saskatchewan. In our high-tech news, Super Mario Maker marks Nintendo video game icon's 30th birthday. In 1985, Nintendo launched a gaming era with the introduction of Super Mario Brothers. It's been 30 years since Super Mario Brothers captivated audience with his intuitive controls and physics-defying jumps, and it helped revitalize an industry many thought dead. The video game industry crashed in 1983, but the humble Super Mario mustachioed plumber revived it. It has sold more than 200 different types of video games based on Super Mario, selling more than 262 million copies worldwide. Says video game giant bomb site Giant Bomb, Jeff Gerstrom on CBC News, that game was the game that launched the modern area of gaming. It was a cultural touchstone in a lot of ways because a lot of people grew up with Super Mario. To celebrate the Plumber's Pearl anniversary, Nintendo is releasing Super Mario Maker on its Wii console. In other story to do with material science, scientists are now looking to make atom layer thick components that could be attached to clothing and that could be invisible. That would usher in a new era of electronics. Remember all the highlight transparent technology Tom Cruise used in his movie Minority Report? Well, it's been 13 years since that movie, but we don't have any see-through devices yet. It turns out that batteries are a big part of the holdup because it is difficult to make batteries invisible. Typically, the materials of batteries are thick and optically absorbent. Creating an invisible battery has become a major challenge in the electronics industry, as demand has increased for transparent phones, wearable electronic sensors, and screens. The lab of Andre Taylor at Yale in the Chemical and Environmental Engineering Department has made a big step towards this goal by developing a technique to make transparent electrodes for lithium iron batteries. The technique is known as spin spray layer by layer assembly, or SSLBL. In this, the researchers created ultra-thin and transparent films from single-walled carbon nanotubes and vanadium pentoxide nanowires to serve as battery anodes and cathodes. Control over deposition has been an issue with the films containing these one-dimensional nanomaterials. Again, nanomaterials are ultra-thin materials that are one atom layer thick and which could usher in a new era of electronics. These materials hold great promise in sensor and electrode applications, but achieving uniform properties such as conductivity throughout the film has been difficult. Now, research are producing electrodes with nanolayer position using SSLBL assembly, a method used in Taylor's lab. Taylor said, and quote, engineering ultra-thin films to store lithium ions is not trivial. What we have achieved, while only a first step, is quite a feat. The next step, said the professor, is creating a transparent separator electrolyte, the third major component of a battery. It's how the lithium atoms travel between the anode and the cathode, which is the positive and the negative terminals. It's a challenge because this component is usually made from mass-produced polymers, and the developers of these systems have not focused on transparency. So the researchers are now focusing on transparency, and they have found an analog in nature. In Costa Rica, a transparent frog species with translucent skin has been discovered. So says the professor, if nature can achieve it through evolution, we should be able to with careful engineering. Now, in another story with micro-thin materials and nanotechnology, superconductivity in graphene has been achieved for the first time. This, by the way, has been achieved at UBC. Researchers at the University of British Columbia, in collaboration with colleagues from the Max Planck Institute for Solid State Research in Europe, have just created the world's first sample of superconducting graphene by coating the materials with lithium atoms. Superconductivity occurs when electrons face no resistance when flowing through the material. This will be achieved only at extremely low temperatures, close to absolute zero, so it is very difficult to achieve. Although superconductivity has already been observed in certain bulk graphites, which are three-dimensional crystals layered with alkali metals, it is difficult to do it in one-dimensional single-layer graphene. So says Professor Damascali from UBC. The first experimental realization of superconductivity in graphene promises to usher in a new era of graphene electronics and nanoscale quantum devices. So these are devices that are ultra thin. They're trying to make them one atom thick, and they will create a whole new world of electronics. The two main reasons for studying graphene: it's a wonder material. It's 200 times stronger than steel by weight, and it has it's very flexible. So this could lead to very fast transistors, semiconductors, sensors, transparent electrode, and other electronic components. So if we think the electronic world is fabulous now, if these research results come to fruition, it will usher in a whole new era. Professor Damascali from UBC said that by decorating monolayer graphene with a layer of lithium atoms, it enhanced its electron-phonon coupling. This occurs when, in superconductor, two electrons, which would normally repel each other, travel together through the superconducting material at temperatures of minus 267 degrees Celsius, or close to absolute zero. The professor said that turning single-layer graphene into a semiconductor would have significant and far-reaching cross-disciplinary applications. And in our last story, Pluto, the New Horizons spacecraft that whizzed by Pluto last month, is returning its photos now. In a flyby on July 14th, 2015, the New Horizons spacecraft looked back towards the sun and captured a near-sunset view of Pluto. It had rugged mountains, icy mountains, and flat plains. The smooth expanse of the informally named icy plain Sputnik Platinum and the Norgay Mountains were featured in this picture. Stay tuned. This is Marco. Next week, I'll update you on the Pluto story. You have been listening to the latest in science and technology news.
Thank you, Marco. We're going to take a quick BS break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here at CITR 101.9 FM.
Are you not sure where to go on campus? Traveling late at night and afraid to go alone?
call SafeWalk, a free service where a co-ed team will take you anywhere you need to go on campus. Don't walk alone. For a walk, add SafeWalk to your phone. Call 604-822-5355. That's 604-822-5355. Alternatively, use a UBC Blue phone and ask for SafeWalk. Approach any SafeWalk team or drop by our office on the main floor of the sub across from the gallery lounge.
Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
My name is David Scott. I play wide receiver for the University of British Columbia football team, and I'm here to discuss the Be More Than a Bystander program. Myself and a few other players were lucky enough to work alongside the BC Lions and EVA, the Ending Violence Association, to support this cause. The main goal of the Be More Than a Bystander initiative is to increase awareness of domestic violence against women. For more information on the cause, please visit endingviolence.org.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM. We're online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Now we have Debbie Lille's documentary for Marine Animals. We are their voices.
I don't know a lot about keeping oceans cleaner.
I do recycle, but sometimes it can be tricky because not everything is properly labeled.
With oceans, it's really getting the plastic in them super bad. The sewers do drain into the ocean sometimes, and that's not great.
I feel like I know it's happening, but I don't think I know a lot about at what pace or what the specific effects are right now or when it's going to be too late for us to do anything.
This is D.P. Lale for News 101 on CITR. The voices you just heard were students at UBC discussing what they know about climate change and healthy marine environments. My previous news stories have always been focused on subjects I was passionate about, including disability and accessibility. Today, I am reporting about another topic that is equally important and needs attention. In March 2014, near Fanny Bay on Vancouver Island, locals spotted a sea lion with fishing line wrapped around its neck. Unfortunately, marine mammal researchers and veterinarians could not save Caillou, who was named by the locals, from being strangled in time because Caillou could not be found when the rescue team arrived. Before I heard this heartbreaking news on BCC TV News, I had no idea what issues faced marine mammals. Caillou's story is just one of many similar cases, and this prompted me to get a better understanding of this ongoing problem and to seek some answers to many questions I had. One being, why was this happening and what was the cause of it? The issue of how human activities are impacting the environment and marine mammals' habitat and lifespans gained a lot of attention in the Lower Mainland. I'm hoping that this project will help show why it is important to be more conscious of our lifestyle choices, as well as show how complicated environmental protection can be when dealing with marine mammals' habitat and survival rates. I spoke to three different professionals in the field who not only do research but also help to rescue individual animals. Our discussions focused on what human activities have the biggest impact on marine mammals and animal rescues. The first person I spoke to was Dr. Andrew Traits. Dr. Traits is a professor at the University of British Columbia and the director of the Marine Mammal Research Unit at the Fisheries Center. Can you tell us what biodiversity is?
Yeah, biodiversity is, it's become a buzz term. And yes, there is, I'm sure, the official definition in Webster's Dictionary. But to a biologist, when we talk about biodiversity, it is effectively talking about the diversity of life in all its forms, recognizing that what makes a system complete is all of the pieces that are part of it, and trying to bring attention to the importance of maintaining all of it, as opposed to only having a couple pieces.
Can you tell me about your work with sea lions?
So I've been studying Steller's sea lions for getting close to 25 years now.
What impact have humans had on marine mammals and their habitats?
There's sort of two parts to this. So one, you know, in terms of the direct impacts people have had on marine mammals, mm-hmm. we've certainly had the period of exploitation when they were being killed and sold. And so that had very direct impacts on their numbers. We've had, in terms of their habitat, we can think of it as just being the quality of the water or the availability of prey and food. But we've also, by introducing toxins and pollution, have also put some chemical problems into the ecosystems, and so they're carrying now some of the same chemicals that are in your body and my body, and some of that have got health implications for them. It affects some of their fertility, potentially their survival and longevity as well. And then we have some of the indirect effects, such as climate change, that the fact that we have such a high standard of living by burning fossil fuels is now impacting the climate, and that's changing the habitat of the animals. So there's all these changes that are happening that are indirect, that we didn't do directly to the marine mammals, but it's indirect, and we really don't know the long-term outcome of what that really means, other than to say things are changing, and the world we know today is not the one that's going to be there in 25 years' time.
What steps do we need to take as humans to prevent further harm on marine mammals?
There are some things that are simple that can have a direct effect in a positive way. So, for example, one of the problems that sea lions are having is that they're putting their heads into these plastic bands, and they're going over their heads, and they are essentially getting their throats cut. It's cutting in, causing infections, interferes with their growth, and that's something which people are putting into the ocean. And so there are some solutions to it. One is to design packing straps that when they do come off will break down if they get into salt water. So there are things that I think the engineers can do to make sure that the garbage that we're throwing into the ocean doesn't kill animals later on. That's not going to make the difference to the species, but it will affect the welfare of some individual animals. The bigger picture probably is back to climate change. And that's going to require not just me or you as to doing something, but entire countries. And it's going to require governments to take this serious and not just pretend that, you know, this climate change thing, it's really going to happen at the next federal election. It's not our problem today. And I'm just not seeing the political will to take any of this seriously. It's not too late to change things, but we're getting close to the point when we're just all going to pay the price.
You mentioned sea lions getting plastic bands caught around their necks. Have you found any patterns around which animals this is happening to?
You know, when we do our field work, we're constantly documenting when we see debris on animals, as an example. It seems that it's males more than females that get into this stuff.
Why is that?
Well, I think maybe it's called testosterone. And playing, and oops, what's this thing around my collar? And so there seems to be some behavioral differences. And I think in the sea lion cases, the females tend to be more cautious. So we are trying to track some of that, because maybe if we can identify which groups are most vulnerable, we can understand why it's happening and maybe find a solution that way. But I think in the end, the solution is going to have to come from people to change the type of gear. So when it does get into the water, it will start to break down and will no longer pose a threat to the animals.
Has the size of the sea lion population been seriously impacted by these kinds of human-created health hazards?
No, it's true that females are more important to the population than the males are because, you know, they have this system that's a polygamous breeding system, and there's all these surplus males hanging around. The future of the population is in the females, and it's the survival of their young, which will pass on their genes. So at the end of the day, as sad as it is, there's a lot of surplus guys around, and they're not all needed.
Thank you so much. We've learned a lot.
Thanks.
The second person I spoke to was Dr. Peter Ross. Dr. Ross is the director for the Ocean and Pollution Research Program at the Vancouver Aquarium.
So my name is Dr. Peter Ross. I'm director of the Ocean Pollution Research Program at the Vancouver Aquarium. This is a new program that we launched just over a year ago, and it was to carry out research on a number of priority areas as we look towards the ocean and we look at our impact on the ocean. So basically, ocean pollution is my cup of tea.
What kinds of marine mammals can be found at the Vancouver Aquarium?
So there are a number of species at the aquarium, including beluga whales. There are Pacific white-sided dolphins that were rescued from a fishery in Japan. There are sea otters that were rescued from Alaska. There are two harbor porpoises that were rescued as well. So a number of species that form an important part of the education and outreach here.
Stories about human marine mammal contact have become more and more prevalent. Are marine mammals living closer to human populations?
I think in British Columbia, we're blessed with having literally hundreds of thousands of marine mammals in our coastal waters. And I think that's an important part of where we come from and who we are today, whether it's Aboriginal myth and storytelling, whether it's food, social, ceremonial for Aboriginal communities, whether it's ecotourism today, you know, whether it's science. I think marine mammals are really, really important to British Columbian cultural heritage. And I think that certainly living right next door to wild populations of marine mammals brings this story home. And I think any time that we as humans tend to see injury or death or impacts on marine mammal populations in our coastal waters, that strikes a chord. That makes us wonder, well, was that our fault? What happened? Can we reduce our impact? Can we do a better job of conserving or protecting this species in the future?
So are there any concerns that sea lions and other marine mammals will become too comfortable with human populations and pose a danger to themselves or to the people who are around them?
Well, certainly the more humans there are on the planet, the more interactions there are with wildlife. But this has been the story of humankind. There have always been interactions between humans and wildlife, humans and food sources. Those interactions have existed since time immemorial. I think as we look ahead, we can certainly see certain examples where the contacts are potentially hazardous, either to the humans or to the marine mammals themselves. And I think sometimes those hazards form parts of anecdotes or media reports. But I think what we have to remind ourselves of is that sometimes they're the exception rather than the rule. There are lots of examples where humans can observe marine mammals or marine mammals can live right next to our own cities with impunity. So I think we have to make sure that when we look at these interactions that we're aware of whether this is an exception to the rule or it's a troubling symptom of us just getting too close to the natural world.
What has a greater negative impact on the health of marine mammals? Is it air pollution or garbage physically in the water?
Excellent question. When we talk about ocean pollution, we're talking about probably 100,000 different pollutants. Sewage effluent, agriculture runoff, industrial chemicals, smoke from cities, etc. And the answer, despite the fact that it's a rather complex question, the answer is fairly simple. It depends on who you are, what marine mammal species you are, whether you're at the top of the food chain or whether you're at the bottom of the food chain.
What's the danger for the sea lions?
We have California sea lions, we have Steller sea lions in British Columbia waters, and these are fish-eating pinnipeds that are doing reasonably well. On the west coast of Vancouver Island, though, both species have been found to get tangled up in nets and straps of unknown origins. We don't really know where these are coming from. We suspect some of it is from the fishing sector. We suspect some of it is from packing straps for crates. Our colleagues on the west coast of Vancouver Island suspect that as many as maybe 1,000 sea lions are tangled in nets and debris. And that's 1,000 individuals that are alive today, swimming, feeding, reproducing, but they're suffering as a result of these nets around their necks. So that's a very visible problem. It's really dangerous and expensive to go and rescue a single individual. But if we knew where those straps were coming from, then we could simply take action at source and say, let's just try to avoid getting those things in the ocean.
What do you think about the future of marine mammals?
I think one of the answers is again, going to be it depends. I think some marine mammals are going to have some challenges in our future oceans. I think in particular, those species that rely on ice or the edge of ice for their existence, like ringed seals in the Arctic, polar bears, beluga whales, some of these species, I think, are going to face some profound changes in their habitat in our lifetime. Other species that might be at risk would be ones that are vulnerable to a depleted food supply, and that food supply might be depleted because of climate change. For example, we know that salmon of different species here in the northern Pacific are at risk because of a climate that is changing. So I'm a little bit apprehensive about some species of marine mammals because of the change in climate. I'm worried about others that are getting entangled in nets. Some of those would be small cetaceans like harbor porpoises or coastal or estuarine dolphins. So there are some that are particularly vulnerable to human impacts or climate impacts. Others that seem to be doing quite well and are recovering or have been recovering since we decided to take protective measures.
What other ways can people get involved in an effort to protect marine mammals?
Excellent question. It's one of my favorite questions, believe it or not, because I kind of view the future on this planet as one where we kind of make a deal with Mother Nature as individuals. And that deal means partnering with industry. It means partnering with our local governments. It means partnering with the federal and provincial governments. But what I mean by this being one of my favorite questions is that we have so much power today as consumers over the products that we can buy, the things that we throw away, the chemicals we use in our houses, the pharmaceuticals that we purchase and flush down the toilet. We have a lot of ways in which I think we can be more informed consumers. And I think that if 3 million or 4 million people in the Vancouver area got even smarter about shopping habits, then I think we would see a much healthier local marine environment around the Strait of Georgia at a minimum. I think that's the kind of deal that I would like to see, where individuals are becoming more informed and more potent stewards of the marine environment.
Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
The last person I spoke to was Dr. Martin Helena. Dr. Helena is the head veterinarian at the Vancouver Aquarium and the Vancouver Aquarium's Marine Mammal Rescue Center. The aquarium is involved in a lot of marine mammal rescues. Over the last few years, injured sea lions have been receiving a lot of media attention. Can you explain what's been causing these animals to require human intervention?
Most recently, we've been involved in quite an effort to try and address a pretty serious problem that's been affecting a lot of our sea lions along our coastline, and that's the issue of entanglement, which causes very severe injuries and cause suffering to go on for quite a long time for both California sea lions and Stellar sea lions. And in order to try and come up with a way to help these animals, we've developed a protocol to dart the animals with an anesthetic combination. That anesthetic combination was developed over a lot of years and was developed with the help of our sea lions that live here at the Vancouver Aquarium. And we've been really successful, I think, it's been about the last 18 months in getting a good group of people together, developing some really kind of unique ways to go out after these animals and to dart them safely and rescue them. The gear that the animals tend to be entangled with are packing straps, so plastic packing straps, as well as a variety of fishing gear and other types of garbage. There's just a lot of stuff that's out there in the water that's affecting our animals. And sea lions are a really kind of graphic example of what our activities can do to animals. But there are so many species that aren't as visual or visible as the sea lions that are affected by our garbage as well. So,
has this situation gotten worse over time?
Really difficult to say. We've got a lot more people in British Columbia that are aware of the environment and aware of animals, and that's great. It's hard to believe, but we're a relatively educated population, and we're a population that really enjoys the outdoors, and we're a population that really cares about our environment and our animals. So there are a lot of people that are out there looking at animals and finding things that are wrong with animals. As well, we have a lot more animals. Since being protected, our sea lion populations have started to come back. And so there's more people around, there are more people looking at animals, and there are more animals to be affected. So in general, yes, probably the problem is increasing. And we believe, through the work of a biologist that we work with, our research associate, Wendy Sanislow, she believes that at any given time in British Columbia, there's 250 to 400 California or Stellar sea lions that are entangled in a variety of gear.
Are there any other ongoing rescue projects the aquarium is involved in?
We've got a lot of different things that we'd like to do. Currently, we're looking at expanding our rescue center, looking at ways to fund our disentanglement trips and expand our capability. We've started sharing our experience with others, so helping to develop a program in Alaska as well as Washington State and California as well for disentanglement has been really important. One of the big efforts we have is looking at post-release monitoring of the animals that come through our facility. So it's really important for us to take an objective look at what happens to the animals that we release, because we want to keep doing better and making sure that we've made the right decisions for animals before we release them. We do satellite transmitter monitoring of animals after we release them. We're helping to develop new instruments that will help us monitor animals for a really long period of time. And, you know, even animals like Levi the harbor porpoise left with a satellite transmitter and showed us that he did great after he was released after being here for a while. So, yeah, good stuff. Those are the big efforts, though, really.
Listeners may be familiar with the story of Caillou, the sea lion who tragically could not be saved. What made this rescue more challenging than others?
Well, actually, it wasn't more challenging than others, but what we've learned time and time again is that it's really difficult for us to try and get to an individual animal when it's reported to us. And where our resources are better used is when we plan a disentanglement trip and go to places where we know there are a lot of sea lions, because statistically we know when there's a lot of sea lions together, we know a few of them are going to have gear on them. And the problem is animals move. They're not consistently in the same place. Unfortunately for us, every time we went out for Caillou, we couldn't find him. He wasn't where he had been the day before. But on every day that we went out after Caillou, we rescued at least one, two, or three other sea lions that were entangled, just because there were other sea lions in the area.
What are other organizations doing to protect marine mammals?
This is a great time to be doing this sort of thing. So many people care about the animals in the natural environment that there are many organizations that we partner with. For the disentanglement issue on its own, we partner with the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, Parks Canada, Canadian Wildlife Federation, and a number of other partners that either help with logistics or with funding. And it's fun. Also, we partner very closely with other aquariums around the world. It's kind of cool because I actually probably know just about every veterinarian at every aquarium or rehab center, marine mammal rehab center around the world. It's a small world, and it's a really collegial kind of world. We're all buddies. You know, when we gather at our conference every year, it's called the International Association for Aquatic Animal Medicine. I call it a gathering of my 250 to 300 best friends, and it's true. It's really, really great.
Sometimes a person's first instinct when they see an animal in pain is to try and help it. But this can be dangerous. What do you recommend people do if they see an animal that isn't injured?
I think for the marine mammals in particular, and you're absolutely right, they can be very dangerous. They can also spread diseases to people and to our pets. And I know everyone's instinct is to help. We really want to help, and that's great. And I don't want to discourage that, except to say that when people who are not experienced are trying to help, often it is to the detriment of the animal that they're trying to help, and also potentially dangerous to the people that are trying to help. So please, if you see anything that you feel is acting like it's in distress or in trouble, give our hotline a call. That's Marine Mammal Stranding Line, or the Department of Fisheries and Oceans hotline for that as well.
And last but not least, what other ways can people get involved in the effort to protect marine mammals?
There are so many ways to get out there and be involved in a positive way. It just here at the aquarium, we've got the Great Canadian Shoreline Cleanup, which is an event every year around beaches nationwide now, doing our best to try and clean up the mess that people have made. That's a great one. Certainly, we have an incredible network of volunteers. At our Marine Mammal Rescue Center, we rely on about 180 full-time volunteers through our busy season that do a lot of the really important work. Of course, anyone can donate, and that money goes directly to our efforts to help individual animals and also our research efforts. You know, there are so many different ways to get involved all the way around the world, but just being informed is so important. Just going out there and enjoying the wildlife and our environment as much as you can, and trying to make sure that we have as little impact while we do those activities as we can.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Caillou's story didn't have a happy ending, but hopefully it raised awareness about entanglement and how important it is to be careful about what we leave in our oceans. His story made me want to learn more about how this kind of situation can be avoided in the future. Environmental change is always happening, whether we like it or not. However, human activities have a major impact on the rate of those changes and can also have a direct impact on the health of wildlife. Entanglement in man-made debris is a serious threat to many individual marine mammals and is an ongoing concern. Over the summer, there were many reports of animals in our coastal waters becoming entangled in fishing gear. Although rescues are often successful and the public is becoming more aware of this issue and reporting sightings to the proper authorities, we need to be more conscious of how our everyday activities can hurt or help our world. Proper disposal of garbage and recycled materials can go a long way. But as I learned through the course of this project, there is no one solution to major climate change. Ultimately, it is our responsibility to educate ourselves on how we can make changes to our lifestyles that have a smaller negative impact on ocean health. There are also many ways to get directly involved in protecting marine wildlife, including the Great Canadian Shoreline Cleanup. And for more information, check out the Vancouver Aquarium's website. As Dr. Helena noted, it can be dangerous and harmful to both human and animal life to attempt a rescue without proper training. If you or someone you know has seen an animal in distress, please contact the Marine Mammal Rescue Center at 604-258-7325 or Fisheries and Ocean Canada at 604-666-0384. Thank you for listening. This is DP Lil for CITR News 101.
That's our program for today, September 18th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Linda Yang.
And I am Shay Marset. Today's broadcast was produced by Emily Blake and Madeline Taylor. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded, right here at CITR 101.9 FM. To close off the show, we have Second Wind by Fake Tears from their latest album, Night Shifting, now topping the charts.